Chapter 14. Spoiler. Late one morning in early December, Operation Migration touched down on a hay farm in Chilton County, Alabama, smack in the center of the state, at the migration's 813th mile. As Joe came in for a landing, a retired veterinarian living on an adjacent property, hearing what sounded like some kind of wailing industrial leaf blower, rushed to his window and was stunned by the sight of a hooded figure in the open-air cockpit of an ultralight descending with a line of white birds snapped behind his wing, like an elaborate kite in a stiff wind. The veterinarian's name was Bubba, and he wasted no time ordering up dinner for everyone. By nightfall, trays of chicken, ribs, sweet potatoes, and turnip greens were spread like a church buffet across a table in Bubba's front yard. Slabs of homemade peanut brittle were being passed around the fire pit. By then, Operation Migration was zipping toward Florida at a phenomenal clip, weeks ahead of where they were the previous year. But a heaviness had set in. Layers of crankiness had accumulated as we rolled south, the way a ball of ice grows, careening downhill. Or at least that crankiness was being shared with me more candidly. I noticed that now, when the pilots met at dawn to assess the weather for flying, there was a subtext to the conversation, in which each of the three men passive-aggressively angled to be the one who made the correct call. Even Gerald, a breezy older fellow on the ground crew who cooked up big egg breakfasts on down days and curates a section of OM's website called Gerald Murphy's Recipes, started dumping on me all of a sudden when we found ourselves waiting for a few minutes in a parked car. He felt he was being taken for granted, he said, and was contemplating volunteering instead for a red-cockaded woodpecker conservation project near his home in Florida. "I miss sleeping in bed with my wife," Gerald told me glumly. But it was Brooke Pennypacker, one of the pilots, who seemed to be having the toughest migration of all. Brooke was 61 that autumn, the same age as Joe, a wry New Jersey native with downy, chalk-white hair and large stores of conversational energy that rarely found an outlet, since he worked with birds he was not allowed to speak near. Some co-workers had taken to calling Brooke the Vortex, because he was known to suck up their time unexpectedly with long and extemporaneous stories. But I'd been drawn to the guy since my first day at Nisida, finding those stories to be invaluable peeks into the wackiness and dreariness of daily life on migration, of what it actually means to have devoted oneself to a bird. Brooke's lifestyle was more bizarre and nomadic than even his fellow crew members. He essentially migrates with whooping cranes year-round, helping to raise each new class of birds from the time they hatch at Patuxent in the spring, relocating with them to Nisida for flight training in the summer, maneuvering the crane south with Operation Migration all fall, and staying behind in Florida to monitor them through their first winter. And by then, it's nearly time for him to start the entire cycle over again. Brooke spent every waking hour on these damn birds now for 7 years, OM's ground crew chief, Walt Sturgeon, told me. That dedication is unbelievable, but he's getting very cynical, and that's too bad. Then again, I don't think there's anything I can do to stop it or change it. By the time OM reached Chilton County, I'd noticed that the stories tumbling out of Brooke were mostly circling back to the same place. Some bemused or defeated complaint about WESAP, or about the other two trike pilots. Usually his ranting was good-humored and self-deprecating. But lately, when he started, I noticed other crew members slowly inch away. Grounded at the hay farm, Brooke and I managed to kill most of a morning talking in the rundown barn. He explained how he'd wound up in this morass of crane politics. It was by accident and for reasons similar to mine. He did it for his child. Brooke has a teenage son, Devin, whom he'd raised mostly on his own for the first 5 years of the boy's life. Devin was about 3 and a half in the mid-90s when Brooke met Joe Duff at a barbecue for ultralight pilots. Joe invited Brooke and his boy to visit him at the Airlie Center, a bird sanctuary and conference center not far from where Brooke was living in Virginia. Joe and William Lishman had led geese to Airlie on Operation Migration's early experimental migrations. Brooke and Devin showed up first, and Brooke sat his son on the slope of an earthen dam so he could take a closer look at a few geese he heard honking in the nearby woods. When he turned around, though, he saw a much larger squadron of geese treading over the top of the dam, moving with clunky determination straight at Devon. Brooke froze. Not knowing anything about geese, he worried they'd peck his son open like a hamburger bun. Instead, the birds only settled all around the little boy, put their heads down, and fell asleep. Brooke told me his son was vibrating and grinning, suppressing a squeal. And I said, "Shit, we've got to do more of this." It wasn't that Brooke was a conservationist or even interested in birds, but he felt compelled to engineer a certain kind of childhood for his son, just as I did for Isla, one that involved being outdoors, around animals, heels dug into nature. "That's our responsibility," Brooke told me. "You've got to expose them to as much of the good as you can." So when the Airlie Center started a project to reintroduce trumpeter swans using ultralights and needed a pilot, Brooke took the job and moved onto the property. Brooke would eventually join Operation Migration in 2002 after one of its original pilots had a stroke. As his son got older, Brooke put him to work at Airlie on weekends, dragging him out of bed in the morning and into a kayak to haze any swans that tried to land in the sanctuary's pond during flight training. In a book about the Swan Project, I found a photo of Devon, then age 8, scrubbing out a swan pool with a long-handled brush. After a while, the kid started to resent it. "He had a lot of years of that," Brooke told me, his voice nearly dropping out from under him. I assumed there'd been a falling out, a fracture of some kind. But for once, a tangent had arisen in a conversation that Brooke Pennypacker declined to go off on. Eventually, we wound around to the story of another family instead. In the fall of 2006, three whooping cranes, two graduates of the ultralight migration and their new offspring, flew from Nisida to the Chaswitzka National Wildlife Refuge in western Florida for the winter. But a drought had dried up much of the adults' traditional territory there, so they shifted to nearby Took Lake, ringed by neighborhoods of ranch homes, a golf course, and a trailer park. As the winter wore on, the three whooping cranes started eating from bird feeders in one particular backyard. Soon they were spending nearly every day at the house, pecking away, unfazed by the bird watchers and neighbors who came to gawp at them up close. When the WESEP trackers knocked on the door of the house, the old woman who lived there refused to take her bird feeders down. One tracker told me, "She was a little bit crazy, a little confusing to deal with. I don't know if she lives alone or what, but no matter what you told her, she was going to feed those cranes." It was a complete breakdown of whooping crane wildness, and it stung especially because these particular birds were supposed to be WESEP's big success story. They were known as the first family. The juvenile was the only chick in the history of the reintroduction that had not been abandoned at its nest and had survived long enough after hatching at Nisida to make a migration with its parents the following fall. It was, in short, a celebrity, the only whooping crane in the eastern United States that had lived its entire life outside a lab, reared by other whooping cranes, not a human in a white gown. It was unimpeachably wild. But now its parents had led it here and taught it to scratch seed from an old woman's hanging plastic tube, like a common sparrow. The humans hadn't failed. The cranes were undermining our ambitions on their own. They were like the humpback that, having been laboriously rescued and sent back to sea, swam back and beached itself. All of a sudden, the philosophical debate about wildness within WESEP had a focal point. Some saw the bird's behavior as an unbearable black eye on the project. But George Archibald, for example, visited the woman's house several times and saw no problem with the arrangement. Once, George told me, he watched the three whooping cranes pass only a few feet away from some kids fishing at the edge of Took Lake without any sign of alarm. The kids ignored the cranes, and the cranes ignored the kids, George remembered. And that struck him as the best situation humanity could realistically hope for. "The purists want these birds to be wilder," he said. "They don't want them hanging around bird feeders or houses in Florida. Well, I'd prefer them to be that way, too. But we live in a fallen world. People are all over the place." George's International Crane Foundation, one of the WESEP partners, even capitalized on the situation by taking some of its donors to Tuke Lake to show off the first family at close range. "Brooke visited the house himself late that January," he told me, arriving in street clothes to watch from an adjacent empty lot. The three cranes strut across the old woman's yard in plain sight and snack on birdseed. It was hard for Brooke not to take insubordination like that personally. Having spent so many summers roasting inside his costume during flight training, supposedly so the cranes wouldn't feel at ease around humans. Suddenly the old woman appeared in her housecoat. She was defensive and argumentative, Brooke remembered, and had already had enough of the whooping crane conservationists showing up at her door and telling her what to do with her bird feeders. I couldn't help picturing one of those crazy pigeon ladies dispensing seed from a collapsible grocery cart on city sidewalks. And just as the woman insisted to Brooke that she was doing nothing wrong, he told me, a wild sandhill crane chick came sauntering around the side of her house, stopped squarely at her feet, and looked up at her like a toddler asking for a treat. Brooke's eyes bugged out. "What's that?" he asked her. "My little sandhill," she told him defiantly. Brooke left, convinced that something needed to be done. But a few nights later, a massive storm surge battered into the whooping crane pen at the Chaswitzka National Wildlife Refuge nearby. The newest class of cranes, which Operation Migration had just led to the refuge from Wisconsin, were still being penned every night while they acclimated to their new habitat, and 17 of the 18 birds drowned that night and died. There was speculation that the cranes were stunned by a lightning strike in the water just before the biggest waves hit. One of the carcasses was found with its talons stuck in the fence, as though the bird had been trying to climb out of the flood. Within days, the 18th bird was found dead elsewhere on the refuge, starved to death or killed by a predator. It wasn't clear. Just like that, an entire year of work was gone. It was the starkest, cruelest setback in the history of the project. Everyone set aside the more nuanced, philosophical setback playing out in the old lady's backyard. Late in the fall, during the whooping crane migration, it was almost winter by then, I visited the woman on Tuke Lake. Her name is Clarice Gibbs, and she lives in a low-slung prefab house on the lake's north side. She has waves of short white hair and dark eyebrows, and speaks haltingly, searching for the right words. In short, not at all the defensive and muttering old bird lady I'd expected. On the phone, she'd sounded touched and relieved that someone finally wanted to hear her side of the story. Gibbs told me that the whooping cranes hadn't been back to her house in years, but her backyard was still a playhouse for all kinds of birds: cardinals, blue jays, chickadees, titmice, woodpeckers, zebra finches, the occasional wood stork. She has been feeding birds ever since she and her husband moved there, she said, some 20 years ago. And I counted more than a dozen bird feeders in her backyard, of all different shapes and colors, hung from trees or hooked to stakes in the grass. A wooden block coated with peanut butter was suspended in a metal cage, a trick she'd read about in a specialty magazine called Birds and Blooms. "Birds are very entertaining," she kept saying. "We just love the wildlife." Gibbs offered me a seat at her dining room table and showed me snapshots she'd taken of the first family. I subsequently learned that there had been whooping cranes at her house, at least occasionally, during the following two winters as well. One of the others was crane number 710, the whooping crane that, having acquired such a fearlessness of humans in her yard, returned to Wisconsin the next spring, became a fixture at the ethanol plant in Nisida, and eventually had to be exiled to a zoo. But Gibbs was having a terrible time that afternoon reconstructing the chronology for me. She strained to sort out many different birds and different winters, she was remembering, and squinted to read the dates printed in the bottom corner of her photographs for help. Frequently, She removed her glasses so she could just rub her temples and think. "You know, John," she said finally, I lost my husband this year, so my dates aren't great. Sometimes I don't get everything together the way I should." It seemed to her that WESEP's trackers started knocking on her door as soon as the cranes arrived. "And I told them," she stammered. "I said, we're not feeding those birds." By this she meant that she was not deliberately feeding the whooping cranes. They were eating food that she put out for other birds. She and her husband knew all about the crane reintroduction, she told me. Everyone did. The men with the airplanes make the local news every winter when they arrive at the refuge with a new group of birds. I read enough about them in the paper to know that they're trying to train them to migrate back and forth, and they don't want human contact, Gibbs said. So she and her husband tried to cooperate, only watching the cranes from their porch and never going into the yard or approaching them. For the most part, she added, the trackers were very nice, very informative. And I could tell that their feelings for the whooping crane are very deep. They want to protect them, and I do too. She wasn't trying to be nasty toward them or disrespectful. And when the whooping cranes left, it didn't bother me at all, because I knew they were supposed to go. They weren't supposed to be here in the first place. But she couldn't afford to lose all the other birds along with them, even temporarily. And that's what would have happened if she took down her feeders. She knew this from experience. She and her husband had taken several long trips, a month at a time, and it always took several months of feeding after they returned to repopulate their backyard with birds. Gibbs then said something that might sound obvious, but she said it very slowly, because it was important that I understand. "If you stop feeding the birds, they stop coming, and you don't get to see them anymore." She took a breath, then suddenly stiffened up. "My husband had Alzheimer's," she told me, "so our porch was a big part of our life." By the time the first family arrived, they'd done all their traveling. I got the impression that those long trips had been a kind of farewell tour to see his family, and were settled in at home, prepared for his condition to get worse. "A big part of our day was watching them," she said, "drinking iced tea on the porch together, noticing the funny things the birds did and the cliques they formed. It was like people watching, but with birds." Gibbs felt bad if she'd spoiled any of the conservationists' hard work, but she wasn't apologetic. After all, she saw herself as being 100% on their side. She was grateful to these men and women who'd worked so determinedly to bring the whooping crane back, because, aside from all the usual reasons, they'd made it possible for one of those birds to alight in her backyard and bless what were effectively some of her last real days with her husband. He was aware enough to get a big old grin on his face when he saw the whooping cranes, she said, and every time their sprawling wings unfolded from their bodies and the three birds lifted off, he'd almost lose his breath. "I was glad," Gibbs told me, "that he still had enough to know that these beautiful birds had visited us." 53 million Americans feed birds outside their houses. But the first family had chosen Clarice Gibbs, and so here I was. Her story was too idiosyncratic, too sad and beautiful at the same time, to reduce to some clear and prescriptive moral. Maybe every story about people and wild animals in America is. Instead, it illustrated only a universal paradox: how wildness fulfills certain human needs and is also trampled by them. How easily we can wind up short-circuiting and celebrating it at the same time. Here was a fundamental tension I'd noticed everywhere, in every era, crunched down into the space of one backyard. All Gibbs had really done was appreciate our planet's flashes of wonder so intensely that she couldn't bear to watch them go away. It was a familiar longing, the same one that sends other people into careers in conservation. When we were done talking, she walked me to her front door and thanked me. I was exhausted and needed to drive 4 hours north to a place in the panhandle called Jefferson County to reconnect with Operation Migration. 2 months after leaving Nisida, they had finally crossed into Florida. As I made for my car, she called after me to stay safe. "There's lots of nitwits driving out there," Gibbs said. Chapter 15. Backpacks Full of Rocks. Jefferson County, Florida, is a spare and bucolic spot east of Tallahassee. It bills itself as the other Florida, and brims with weeping oaks and meandering roads. The county is named for America's third president and most zealous moose collector. Coincidentally, I read that because of some fluke of geology along the Ocilla River, archaeologists have dug up many prehistoric mammoth bones in Jefferson County. Operation Migration had gotten the cranes to Jefferson 3 days earlier, setting down in a tremendous grass field miles from anything after another hot streak of flights. Brooke parked his trailer next to a pile of gravel and camped there alone, preferring solitude and the company of the cranes, while the rest of the crew found hookups for their RVs at a nearby KOA campground. All of a sudden, OM was threatening to polish off the migration, likely their last ever, within days. In Jefferson County, Operation Migration's route forks. Ever since the storm surge killed the class of 2006 at the Chaswitzka National Wildlife Refuge, the cranes have been divided between two refuges for the winter to hedge against another disaster. Half the birds are taken to Chaswitzka, but half are deposited farther north first at the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge on the Gulf Coast. It's a quick 28-mile hop to St. Mark's from Jefferson County, and since the weather looked marginally better in that direction, the crew was staging to deliver those birds first. The refuge staff and the town of St. Mark's were standing by to throw its annual arrival party, in which hundreds of craniacs come out to witness the trikes and cranes fly in. A stage is set up. The crew gives speeches. It lends a feeling of finality to the months-long epic, even if the other half of the flock hasn't yet reached its home. It was well after dark by the time I got to the KOA campground from Gibbs's house. I knocked on the door of Operation Migration's largest RV, the crew's collective living room, and found Joe and two other crew members, Walt Sturgeon and Jack Ryder, watching Antiques Roadshow in a near-anesthetized trance. They'd been grounded in Jefferson County for 2 days already. The wind was hostile, and the temperatures at sunup had been so obscene, 20 degrees, 17 degrees, that, elsewhere in Florida, manatees were huddling around coastal power plants, warming themselves in the outflowing plumes of hot water, and volunteers were kayaking into the Gulf of Mexico to ladle out sea turtles that were floating belly up, stunned by the cold, then rushing them to triage centers and bundling them into blankets. I'd expected that once OM got this close to their destination, a levity or forgiving feeling of mutual accomplishment might set in. Instead, there was only the numbness of shift workers still a few hours from the end of a long day. On the television, a woman in San Antonio stood next to her set of Chinese porcelain paintings and told the appraiser, "It's called The Four Seasons of Rice Planting." You could see her practically pulsating, her hope that these heirlooms would be worth a fortune, working hard to outstrip the shame of hoping for anything at all. The camera zoomed in on the joint of one bamboo frame. Walt, who has apparently done some woodworking, muttered from the RV couch, "The corners don't even match up." Without looking away from the television, Joe and Jack both said, "Nope." Just then, someone read out the next day's weather forecast from the RV's back room. What he said was impenetrably numeric to me, lots of knots and altitudes. But given the reaction in the RV, which was no reaction, I took it as bad news. It wasn't. The forecast looked decent. But after 7 states and 65 days on the road, no one wanted to believe it yet. The next day, as it happened, was another squally down day. After some waffles at the KOA, I picked up Brooke at his trailer and we drove to the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge. The tracking team was reporting that 6 older whooping cranes had recently returned to the refuge for the winter, the first birds to finish their southward migration that year, and we were hoping to catch sight of them. It seemed as good an excuse for an outing as any. The trip that Operation Migration had been waiting days to make in the air took less than an hour in my rental car. There was something immediately rejuvenating about St. Mark's. Every migration stopover is purposefully remote, a cloistered dimple in the woods. But here the scenery was wide open and brand new, seared with prismatic greens and blues. New kinds of birds, ibises and other shorebirds, flew in low lines between marshes. This was a homecoming for Brooke. He spends every winter at the refuge, and at the visitor center, a trio of women trickled out of the office to welcome him back. They'd printed out the online bios for that year's cranes and were eager to know which 5 of the 10 were coming to live at their refuge, pressing Brooke for their secret names. Though Joe insists on only referring to the birds by number, Brooke finds it impossible to train them so closely and not give them nicknames. "Nobody has a kid named Number 13," he told me. Brooke smiled coyly and divulged only one secret name, Rocky. Then, after some more chit-chat, we were on our way. We wound up on the beach at the foot of the refuge's old lighthouse and gazed for a while at the water as the sky turned overcast. I don't remember what I asked Brooke, but it must have touched a nerve, because he started once again lamenting the discord inside WESEP and the friction between him and the other trike pilots. The other day, he said, he was standing in a Walmart making a run for cut-rate canned foods when he turned and saw a little boy at the leg of his mother. The child was pointing at Brooke. He recognized him from OM's website and gawped. His mouth hung open so wide that Brooke could see the socket of a missing baby tooth. It made Brooke feel small inside. "I feel like I'm scamming these people, at least a little bit," he said. By now, it's as though he and his co-workers have been turned into human polar bears, emblems that some people desperately want to rally around and that help them believe in good. We on the ground are imprinting on these costumed men, too, hoping to be shown what's possible with enough ingenuity and hard work. Brooke seemed to understand this in his own humble way. But, he said, he also knows how uncivil the partnership has been lately behind the scenes, and how guilty he is of getting carried away with his resentments. And he knew that if he let even a speck of that cynicism come across, standing in the aisle at Walmart, it might shred something priceless inside that little kid. All fall, I'd been stunned by how open everyone working on the whooping crane reintroduction had been with me, and especially the people of Operation Migration, whom, as the migration proceeded, it was clear I'd caught in a moment of great rawness and uncertainty. Now I leveled with Brooke. I told him that the coarseness I'd encountered in the partnership was making me lose hope a little, too. But how could he feel that same disillusionment and still throw himself into the sky every morning to push the birds forward? "I'm just fucking stupid," he said. He was almost shouting now. "Believe me, at the end of the day, I want to call up my son and beg forgiveness, because it was all an accident. I wanted to get my son involved in birds because it seemed like a good thing to do, and I didn't want to be a shitty father. And what did I do? I ran away to be a bird guy and wound up being a shitty father. Now he's in college and he doesn't even answer the phone half the time I call." "I didn't give a shit about birds at the beginning," he went on. "I'm not an altruistic person. I'm not even really a nice guy." But the Whooping Crane Project had materialized in front of him, and it was just as though he were driving down a highway, saw someone broken down on the shoulder, and knew he had a jack in his trunk. A very simple thought rose up in his mind. "I can do this. This is something I can do." Now he was determined to keep at it until the thing was fixed. "The way I look at it," Brooke said, "is that everybody, every one of us, has this big sack around our neck, a backpack full of fucking rocks. Being evil, being bad, and being greedy. All the human shit, all of our frailties, everything that makes us human, they're all packed in a great big bag on our backs. We're born with it. For millions of years, humans have been loading that pack. So, unless you're Jesus or Mother Teresa, you've got this pack to carry. And we carry it into WESEP meetings, We carry it on the flight with the birds. We carry it into the motorhomes at night. We carry it into our relationships, into parenthood. Always, always, you're carrying this fucking pack. The whooping crane restoration, Brooke went on, is like a long swimming pool that everyone has to swim across together. There's not many people that are going to swim with the fucking pack on their back full of rocks, he said. But a lot of the people in this project make that swim. And even though they're carrying all this negative shit, they're down in there, splashing, splashing, trying to get to the other side. I know I can sound negative. Everyone's always telling me, oh, you're so negative. I get out of those WESEP meetings, and I'm just looking for a bridge to jump off. But what I have to remind myself is that the people in that room were trying. They're all just carrying their packs. We're never going to shed that baggage, but at least we can carry it in the right direction. The dysfunction didn't surprise him, in other words. It was infuriating, yes, but not something to be defeated by. He was staring at the same absurdity that Joan McIntyre saw, the way people's good intentions can so easily curdle when combined. But he wasn't about to give in the way she did, to tender his resignation with bouquets of daffodils. There's an inevitable entropy in people, a wildness inside us, that tugs at the threadwork of everything we do. Even a job that looks so idealistic and decent can get pocked with misunderstandings, egos, and competition. But that's what every human enterprise is like. That's what every habitat is like. To call it unfair is a cop-out. It's the natural order that our species fights to transcend. You can't take humanity out of the equation, Brooke told me. Humanity caused the problem to begin with, and so it's very hard for humanity to solve the problem, because it's humanity. You know what I mean? We bring to the table all the same crap that was brought to the table to create the nightmare in the first place. Maybe this sounds deflating, too jaded and profanity-laced to lay out for a kid in Walmart, or, for that matter, for a high schooler looking into a polar bear's eyes on Buggy One. But I swear, on the beach at St. Mark's, it felt like the most reassuring thing I'd heard any conservationist say. This is all there is, and all there ever could be. Achingly imperfect people, working to achieve something more moral than they are. It's not a bird project, Brooke said. It's a people project. The birds are an excuse for doing something good. Early the next morning, with a plum-red sun still concentrated at the horizon, I was scrunched into the back seat of a Cessna, looking down on Jefferson County's quilt of cattle pastures, farmhouses, and radio towers. Piloting the plane were Operation Migration's top-cover pilots, Jack Ryder and John Cooper, two retired commercial airline pilots who, on migration days, soar 1,000 feet over the trikes and cranes, working the radio to clear any air traffic ahead, and keeping an eye out for wayward birds. This morning, the 5 whooping cranes bound for St. Mark's were finally going to fly the 18th and final leg of their migration. While Joe Duff's trike soared high and kept its distance, Brooke circled toward the light bulb-shaped field where the cranes were penned. "Okay," I heard him say over the radio. "Let 'em out." The door opened. The cranes swaggered out of the pen rather than surged, then gathered into the air lackadaisically as Brooke made a low pass to pick them up. They didn't form a line at his wing, but vibrated slackly behind his trike as they climbed. 5 shapes, pumping like uncoordinated pistons. There was a protracted power struggle, a crane rodeo, as the pilots call it. But within 20 minutes, Brooke had sorted the 5 birds behind his left wing, and the migration settled in at 1,200 feet. Soon we were crossing the Wasissa River en route to St. Mark's. Joe was drifting 500 feet above Brooke. We in the Cessna were 500 feet above Joe, flying in broad circles to keep from creeping too far past the convoy. Ahead, I could see the tidy rows of pine forests bisected by roads, and the long coastal highway mirrored by a parallel highway of high-tension wires. Beyond that, a silver power plant rose out of the flat earth, glinting and disgorging dull white smoke. Then, at the Gulf Coast, everything faded to blue. Jack, the Cessna pilot, announced that we were 31 minutes away from the wildlife refuge. At that moment, 600 people and a couple of local television crews were waiting on a long, carpet-like lawn at the edge of the town of St. Mark's, just across an emerald estuary from the refuge. Among them, I'd later learn, was a man from Ontario, Canada, who, a few days earlier, had read online that the migration was closing in on its endpoint and asked his girlfriend, "Want to go see the whooping cranes fly in?" An hour later, they were in their van, driving to St. Mark's. There were two sisters, ages 9 and 12, whose parents had offered them each $25 to go to school that day, but who turned down the money so they could fake the flu and come collect autographs from Operation Migration's crew. There was an elderly woman who, inexplicably, had brought a used space pen, the kind that writes upside down, as a present for Brooke. And there were two doughy, jovial young guys, volunteers at the refuge, who'd sneaked into the observation tower next to the pen where the cranes were being delivered and, given that it was now the middle of December, nailed up 5 Christmas stockings, embroidered with each of the whooping cranes' numbers, and a wooden sign that read, "Home, sweet home." 31 minutes from now, they would all look up and watch Brooke's trike pass directly overhead at 500 feet, low enough so that when he banked left to steer the cranes over for a second showing, everyone on the ground could see the broad white arm of his costume waving to them. Soon we were 24 minutes away, then 18 minutes out. The whooping cranes hadn't so much as twitched from their places behind Brooke. There was nothing to do. In the Cessna, Jack reached into the back seat beside me and pulled a granola bar from the pocket of his coat. Very late the previous night, I'd run into Joe at the KOA campground's game room. I was looking for internet access. That winter, when I wasn't on migration, I was home touring preschool after preschool with my wife, and now I'd promised that I would bang out all the applications before I came home from Florida. It was dark out, and through the game room window, behind a nativity scene of porcelain miniatures, I could see Joe, sitting in a folding chair in an Operation Migration sweatshirt, one arm drooped across the exercise machine beside him. He had a load of laundry going in the coin-op washer outside and was waiting to dry it. His head was winched up, uncomfortably it seemed, so he could stare at the television mounted from the ceiling. The only light in the game room came from a Christmas tree in the corner and the flickering of 2½ men. I stopped for a second on the path outside because I wanted to remember the image. It was a portrait of the 21st century conservationist on the road, a man without the luxury of believing that anything would be simple or of any expectation of closure, but still trying. In the end, the embittered atmosphere around the whooping crane reintroduction had only made me admire everyone in the partnership more, because even as they thwarted themselves, everyone was still trying. There was no getting around that fact, and so much dignity in that persistence. I had never seen courageousness or heroism that looked quite like it. It was heroism in the Sisyphean sense, just as all conservation may be, since implicit in that work now is the impossibility of its ever being finished. It requires rallying the will to build something that the future is likely to erase. Even Joe, in one of his darker moods, had admitted to me, "There's no hope for whooping cranes in the long term. Climate change, for one thing, will put much of the marshland we've protected for the species underwater." Joe seemed acutely conscious of how much climate change might upset or wreck. And he worried about the plastic infusing the world's oceans, too, and overpopulation, the whole litany of environmental terrors. "I've been involved in this for so long, I'm to the point now that I wish I hadn't had a daughter," he confessed. "I worry my daughter's going to have a shit life. I really do. That's scary. I mean, we've left a mess. I think the world is facing a major crisis, and nobody cares. And I don't know what to do. Do you? But I feel like I'm doing something useful. I'm doing something. and I don't know if it's going to work out or be worth anything, but at least we're trying. I didn't have any better answers. After everything I'd seen, I had no solution for fixing a broken world. But then again, that's only one of the problems we're facing. Another is just figuring out how we are supposed to live in a broken world. And, I realized, more than anything having to do with wild animals or biodiversity or the environment, that was the problem that I'd been wanting to give my daughter a head start in solving for herself. Back in the Cessna, a voice cut in on the radio. "You guys still on course?" It was Liz, Operation Migration's woman on the ground in St. Mark's. She was standing on the stage at the party, killing time as best she could, reminding the crowd of Craniacs to buy their Operation Migration t-shirts and videos and Whooping Crane Christmas ornaments. People were desperate for an update. I could picture them assembled on the lawn, blowing into their hands or resting them on their sons' and daughters' shoulders, all turned to face in the same direction, searching the sky for movement. I suddenly realized that none of us in the air had said a word in a long, long while. The radio had been silent. I don't think Brooke had spoken at all. I'd spent most of the flight staring out my window at him in his trike, 1,000 feet down, with the 5 whooping cranes fastened to his wing, the 6 of them in white, tied together as one object and hanging over Florida like a mobile above a crib. It's what I remember most, not the arrival, but the long, uncertain lull beforehand. "We're 8 miles out," Joe finally answered. "We're looking for you," said Liz. Epilogue: The Man Who Carried Fish. I started out from home early one morning, long after the whooping crane migration was finished, closing the car door softly and rolling away from the curb under Isla's bedroom with the headlights off so I wouldn't wake her. 7 hours later, having twisted through the snow-caked Sierra and wound south, I reached Phil Pister's house in a small desert town called Bishop, California. Pister had celebrated his 83rd birthday 2 weeks earlier. His skin was bronzed and rough-looking and pooled off his hands. I'd come to ask him to tell me a story I'd heard in the course of my research a couple of times, but only second-hand and in the broadest strokes possible, as though it were a myth from outside of time. It was the story of one man, Phil Pister, who was tested in the desert. People called it the Species in a Bucket story. "It was August 18th, 1969, Pister began. He was 40, and already 15 years into his career as a fish biologist with the California Department of Fish and Game, here in Bishop. One afternoon, a young guy who worked for him named Bob Brown swept through his office door. The kid looked on edge, and he says, 'Phil, we've got to get out to Fish Slough, because if we don't, that pond is going to dry up.'" Fish Slough is a narrow, marshy depression in a valley of pale green scrub north of town. Water burbles out of the sand from a handful of springs at the north end, then flows south before heading for the Owens River. Much of the land in and around Bishop is owned by the city of Los Angeles. For almost a century, the city has re-engineered the landscape into a giant funnel, diverting water to its residents more than 200 miles away. Water has also been pumped out locally. Gradually, a rambling network of pools tightened into a thin spindle of water. And that particular summer, during a long heat wave, the high grasses were sucking the slough dry without anyone's noticing, except Bob Brown, the kid in Pister's doorway. What Bob didn't say when he came in, Pister explained, but what was very obvious, is that if the pond dries up, a species is gone. The Owens pupfish lives in the pools at Fish Slough and nowhere else in the world. It's 2 inches long and otherwise so mundane-looking that it escaped my powers of description, no matter how intently I stared at the photo of one on Pister's wall and tried to jot down something meaningful about it in my notebook. It is beige. One biologist told me that before European settlement, The Owens pupfish lived in Fish Slough by the zillions. But by the 1940s, with the pools in Fish Slough shriveling, the species had been presumed extinct. It was rediscovered by two visiting scientists in 1964. Pister was in the field with them, and, he told me, seeing a small riot of these ghosts still zipping around in the water, he experienced something comparable to a religious enlightenment. All of a sudden, the work he did for the state government seemed worthless. "Not only did I drop everything right then, John," Pister said, "but I never picked it up again." There are roughly 1,000 lakes in the region around Bishop, and Pister's job at the time was to fill them and keep them filled with the species of fish that fishermen wanted to catch. America has been stocking its waterways with non-native fish, at least informally, for more than 100 years, just as game wardens might introduce deer, elk, partridge, and other animals for hunters. Even John Muir, the prophetic champion of raw wilderness in the Sierras, advocated fish stocking. Good fishing opportunities, Muir argued, would draw Americans into the mountains where they could be rejuvenated. Trout were bait for catching men, for the saving of both body and soul. When Pister was on the job, fish stocking was a multi-million dollar state-run operation. Like many states, California still does a fair amount of it. Trucks dumped trout and bass, mass-produced in hatcheries, into lakes and streams near the roadside. Mules carried them into the backcountry. At the most remote lakes, airplanes flew overhead and opened their hatches, and fish came raining down. In a way, the entire undertaking was a mirror image of the monumental salmon conservation project that the fish counters are a part of at Bonneville Dam. Back then, Pister was keeping rivers full of the fish that America thought were most delicious. Now there's a movement to keep them filled with the fish we think are most ecologically appropriate. Either way, though, you could argue, we are engineering nature to satisfy our taste in fish. Seeing the Owens pupfish still alive in 1964, Pister suddenly flipped from one mindset to the other. He realized he'd been devoting his life to supplying fishermen from Los Angeles with coolers full of trout. Meanwhile, the region's native fish were quietly vanishing, largely into the stomachs of the bigger, hungrier fish that Pister was setting loose in their territory. And so he started working behind his boss's backs to restore Fish Slough, trying to give the newly resurrected Owens pupfish a fighting chance to rebound there. Soon he was laboring for the benefit of other native fishes, too. That is, Pister was spending enormous amounts of his own time and money undoing exactly the sort of improvements that he was engineering at his day job. By 1969, when Bob Brown came to Pister's office door, there were about 800 pupfish living in a single small pool at Fish Slough. This was the pond Brown was warning him about, the one going dry. Pister grabbed Brown and another co-worker and raced to the site. There was still water left in the pond, but it was hot and virtually stagnant, bereft of oxygen. Many fish were dead. The men netted as many of the living ones as they could and transplanted them into live cages, small cloth-sided boxes that allow water to circulate through but keep the fish contained. Then they put the live cages closer to the mouth of the spring, where the water was flowing more rapidly. The ordeal was over, it seemed. It was dark now, Pister told me. I told my buddies to go get something to eat. Pister watched them drive away and started cleaning up. Before he headed home, he decided to take one last look. The situation had changed entirely. Many of the pupfish in the live cages were now swimming belly up at the surface, knocking into the thick, drifting traffic of those that were already dead. I could see the bottom line on this. None of them were going to be alive much longer, he told me. And that is when I went across the marsh, holding those two buckets. He had 2 5-gallon buckets in his truck, the big white kind that they make pickles in, he explained. He filled them with water and began scooping up the fish that were still alive and putting them into the buckets. Then he lifted the handles and started to walk. It was 200 yards back to his truck. Pister had taken a few steps when the harrowing thought occurred to him that he was carrying the totality of a species in his two hands. He scanned the ground for snares of barbed wire and other obstacles, trying not to trip. Then he loaded the buckets onto his truck bed, sat in the driver's seat, and turned the key. He'd made a snap decision to move the fish to another spring at the opposite end of Fish Slough, where he knew the water was cooler and deeper. The two springs are about a half mile apart and connected by a dog-legging dirt road that is packed with rocks. It is not a smooth ride. I asked again and again, but Pister couldn't remember what was going through his mind that night as he crept through the dark in his pickup, the two buckets of fish standing side by side on the truck bed behind him, joggling and splashing as he drove. I could almost see him, this minor Noah, moving the animals through an imperceptible flood. But there was a matter-of-factness to Pister's telling. He was confronted with a small, obvious crisis and saw a way to solve it. So he did. When he finished telling his story, Pister just looked at me and said, "It's something you do, you know?" In 1931, near the end of his life, William Temple Hornaday began his last book by slinging insults at America's most prominent conservationists. He had given up on groups like the Audubon Society. They seemed to him cowardly and ineffective. Conservationists were not saving anything from destruction, he wrote, but only humbly meandering along behind the firing lines, picking up the cripples. Hornaday called the book 30 Years' War for Wildlife, Gains and Losses in the Thankless Task. It was both a memoir of his many campaigns and a continuation of the same spittle-ejecting invective he'd been writing for most of his life. By then, he'd become insufferably morose. In the book's final section, called The Curtain, he wrote, "Regarding the future of the wildlife of North America and the world at large, the author of this volume is a calamity howler and a pessimist of the deepest dye. He had tried to inject humanity and courage into the hearts of men, to awaken them to the value of their nation's wildlife, but now believed it couldn't be done. Maybe," he wrote, "the only hope for preserving animals now was to control the appetites of Americans despotically with the power of a Mussolini." "Think it over," Hornaday wrote, "but meanwhile, prepare for the worst." It's now been 40 years since America passed the Modern Endangered Species Act, committing itself to a brand of ecological idealism that really isn't so different from what drove Hornaday. It's pretty simple stuff, rooted in the same kinds of lessons that Isla is now learning at preschool. Be considerate of others. Don't take more than your share. Clean up your mess. Understandably, beliefs like those will start to feel paradoxical or confused when the children who have internalized them start applying them to a larger, more complicated world. Even the situation of the Owens pupfish isn't as simple as the species in a bucket story makes it sound. I'd imagined Pister, having reached the end of the road, tenderly tipping the buckets into the new spring and watching the pupfish scatter. But in fact, he had first to poison out all the other predatory fish there. Then, later that summer, he built a gravel dam to shore up that new sanctuary. And on the management went, and still continues today. When I visited Fish Slough recently, a retired government biologist named Terry Roussey told me that the pupfish are really no better off than they were 45 years ago, when Pister moved them. The species lives in only four tiny pools, one about the size of the truck that Pister rescued it in, and right-wing residents of Bishop, with their ideological disdain of government projects, have occasionally tried to sabotage the operation by putting bass in the slough to gobble up the endangered fish and end the whole affair. By now, the government doesn't even disclose the locations of some Owens pupfish habitats, and there are no signs about the fish at Fish Slough. Instead, the spring where Pister brought his buckets that night is fenced with barbed wire, attended by a $17,000 instrument to measure its flow, and blockaded at one end by a fish-proof barrier to keep out predatory fish and keep the pupfish inside. The scene was part witness protection program, part hospice. Standing at the edge of the pond, Russi explained that if vegetation is allowed to build up on the barrier's stainless steel grate, the way scirpus and bulrush reeds had collected there now, the barrier won't work. Predators can swim right over it. And so, mid-sentence, Russi suddenly dropped to all fours and started pulling the reeds out. This is what a lot of America's war for wildlife looks like, 40 years into its current phase. 10 years longer than Hornaday had been fighting his own war when he finally seemed unable to stomach it anymore. And in fact, over the last 10 years, support for all kinds of environmental causes has sagged in our country. Conservationists have been driven to take more absolute and truculent stands because they believe that even the smallest defeat will erode the bigger principles. They've opposed solar panel arrays and wind farms, green energy projects that would, in theory, help all species, for the sake of the desert tortoises or imperiled birds that live nearby. Meanwhile, on the other side, fuses have started blowing. During the time I was writing this book, I kept noticing headlines about horrendous explosions of spite toward protected species. The corn and soybean farmer in Minnesota, for example, who in 2011 became so irritated by the federally protected American white pelicans trampling his crop that he eventually snapped and smashed thousands of their eggs and stomped young chicks to death. Since 2007, 11 whooping cranes have been found shot dead in the wild. One was the matriarch of the first family, and in that case, even though government investigators found the shooters and got a conviction, an unimpressed judge in Indiana sent the men away with a $1 fine. This is why, when I'd first heard the species in a bucket story, I assumed it wasn't true. It sounded too pat, like just the sort of fable that American conservationists would need to tell themselves at a time when their work has become mercilessly convoluted and drawn out. The simplicity of what happened at Fish Slough in 1969 seemed to absolve everyone and bring the entire issue back into comprehensible terms, a basic place of agreement from which we might start over. There are definitely people who wouldn't have gone through the trouble to move those fish had they been in Phil Pister's place. But if you strip away the politics, the money, the philosophical arguments, and the appeals to moral responsibility, if you just see the man and the fish, I'd like to believe that almost everyone can appreciate why he did. Even Isla understood it. "Because fish need water," she explained, when I got back from Bishop the next evening and told her the story. "What a great story," Brooke Pennypacker said. It was September, a year after the whooping crane migration I'd followed to Florida began, and Brooke and I were having dinner at a roadhouse deep in central Wisconsin. I just repeated the legend of Fish Slough for him, and Brooke, who saw life as nothing but a chain of stories, was now visibly turning over the implications of this one in his mind. Operation Migration had survived, at least for another year. That January, the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership finally found another site from which to launch an ultralight migration, now that Nisida was off the table. A remote state wildlife preserve called White River Marsh. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources hustled to get all the permits hammered into place only 2 weeks before Operation Migration needed to start training cranes. Then a gaggle of craniacs arrived to help. A pen needed to be built. A pond had to be dug. Trees had to be felled to clear a runway for the trikes. They worked in a downpour, like neighbors raising a barn. The week I visited White River Marsh, Brooke was the only pilot on site, handling the flight training with two interns. I found the crew's familiar squadron of RVs parked in overgrown grass around a dilapidated farmhouse. The pig farmer who'd owned the property had died, and the state of Wisconsin planned to demolish the house and fold the land into the wildlife preserve. It seemed possible, though, that some of the structures might crumple to the ground first on their own. Kittens skittered near the squalid barn like street kids in a Dickens novel. What I mostly noticed when I got out of my car, though, was the smell. There was a pile of pigs over there until a couple of days ago, Brooke explained. I'd expected to find Brooke wallowing in exile. After all, the fate of Operation Migration was hardly less uncertain than when I'd last seen them. And the migration the crew was about to start that fall would turn out to be their most exasperating yet. They would lose one bird mid-flight before even leaving Wisconsin. Not have it die, but physically lose it. And later be grounded briefly by the Federal Aviation Administration because of some oblique quibble the agency had with OM's nonprofit status. By Christmas, the migration would only reach Alabama and be stranded there so long because of weather that when they tried to fly again, the birds, likely assuming they'd reached their winter home and losing their physiological urge to migrate, would refuse to follow. The cranes would be boxed, driven to a nearby wildlife refuge, and left to spend the winter there instead. For the first time, in other words, OM would fail to make it to Florida. Still, right now at least, Brooke was upbeat. When I asked if it was tough to be shunted onto this isolated pig farm, he told me that he appreciates the solitude, actually, and that the public library in the nearby town is much better than the one in Nisida. Last year at the refuge was not a comfortable situation, he said. It was a slow tightening of the rack. He was, in fact, much happier and looser than when I'd last seen him, as if he'd somehow wound back the mileage accumulated the previous fall and restored the good humor that had gotten sapped out of him. He was back in his element, which is to say, he was pushing as hard as he could, in all directions, against many small and immediate frustrations. The birds that were slow to follow his trike during training. The pig stench he slept in. The little picture, Brooke said, is a whole lot easier to deal with than the big picture. That's for sure. You could argue that this is the crux of a terrible problem. In the end, I can't say I'm optimistic about the future of wildlife. The stories of the polar bear, the butterfly, and the whooping crane had, at times, even lowered my confidence in our ability to see the problem clearly. There's a fluidity to nature that's not easy to recognize or accept, and climate change will only accelerate and distort such changes. There's also a fluidity to how we feel about nature, the way our baselines subjectively reset and will keep resetting far into the future, while in the background, the empirical damage piles up. These are destabilizing thoughts. I still don't know what to do with them. But neither does anyone else, it seems. And so their weight has a way of compressing conservation down into a nearsighted exercise, one that can be pursued only by focusing on the little picture of the present and by blocking out the yawning uncertainty that moment is adrift in. Then again, it was people's capacity to focus on that little picture that I found so invigorating everywhere I went, and to keep refocusing on it. Having reached a place of devastating pessimism, to return somehow to a place of, not optimism exactly, but at least relative equanimity. Maybe what conservation tries is sometimes misguided or futile, but there's something deep and blameless in the trying itself. A spark we can feel defined by as humans and should point out to our kids. Invariably, the many battle-scarred old conservationists I met told me they failed. But really, having been thwarted, they usually just refocused that same moral energy in different ways. For all his saltiness, Jerry Powell, the lepidopterist, still Xeroxed and mailed a copy of his Antioch Dune study to every fish and wildlife employee who asked for one. Joanna Varawa told me she was now striving to act compassionately toward those immediately around her on Lanai, with the same forthrightness with which she tried to gather up the compassion of all humanity to save the whales. Even Rudy Mattoni, who told me he'd given up, told me it in those exact words, had definitely not given up, but was instead settling into his corner of the jungle with a net and a notebook to preserve the memory of every last insect he could. If they'd all given up, why did they spend so much time talking to me so I could write their stories down? And how was it that, during those conversations, they could access such ardent, if not obsessive, feelings of frustration all over again, if they weren't still trying to unscramble for themselves the same question that I'd apparently gotten stuck on too? How on earth should we human animals live? I'd been picking apart the stories we tell about wildlife, hoping to find a firm conclusion, or even some new and useful vision for our shared future together. But I never came close. America rewrites those stories so erratically over time, and so impulsively, that few of them feel convincing in the end. Instead, I'm convinced by the stories that we use wild animals to tell about ourselves. The best of us are cursed with caring, with a bungling and undying determination to protect whatever looks like beauty, even if our vision is blurry. People keep warning me that Isla's generation will blame us for losing so much of that beauty. But whatever, it's inevitable, and I'm trying to make my peace with it. It's comforting that they'll still imagine better, and it will occur to them to be angry. As the fog cleared at White River Marsh the next morning, I stood in a blind with a small group of craniacs and watched Brooke train the new class of birds. It seemed to go very badly.
"I think they've still got a lot of learning to do," an old lady next to me whispered.
Afterward, Brooke rushed out to a cement slab hangar that OM was renting to meet two inspectors from the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA had called out of the blue, wanting to inspect their trikes. Given the crew's trouble with the agency later that fall, the inspection feels foreboding in retrospect. Brooke may have half understood that at the time. But while the two men meandered around each aircraft, ticking boxes on their clipboards, he merely did what he always did. He talked. He explained the project to the inspectors, the costumes, the imprinting, the long push to Florida, and before long, seemed to be winding his way back to a conversation that he and I had had at dinner the night before. He told me about one morning that spring when he was still at the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge in Florida. Two of the cranes I'd watched Operation Migration deliver to the refuge at Christmas had already left on their northbound migration back to Nisida. Brooke was waiting for the last three to decide to depart. At sunup one day, after checking the birds and doing his usual battery of chores, Brooke, playing a hunch, settled into the blind next to the pen to watch. Half of the pen has no top. The birds come and go as they please all winter, typically exploring the refuge by day and flying back into roost at night. Sure enough, the three birds soon issued a long, blaring call and launched. They coiled higher into the blue. Brooke watched them vanish. On his receiver, he heard the beeps of their tracking bands get softer and softer as the cranes soared out of range. Then, finally, he couldn't hear anything anymore. They were on their way. Immediately, Brooke told me, he started packing up. He hurried around the blind, taking the maps off the walls, and walked into the pen to unhook the feeders. Then I say to myself, "Slow down a minute." This was it, after all. The moment everyone worked for. For the first time since the cranes had hatched at Patuxent, they were on their own. They were wild. Soon, Brooke would drive to Patuxent and start the process all over again, with new chicks. But the brief sliver of every year between the end of one cycle and the beginning of the next had started the second those three birds vanished in the sky. Brooke walked into the shed next to the pen and sat down among the leftover bags of crane chow. It used to be that, after dropping the whooping cranes at the refuge in Florida, he and the other pilots would bounce out of their cockpits and start high-fiving each other and hugging. But in the past few years, it hadn't even occurred to them to celebrate. They touched down and, without a word, began briskly dismantling the wings of their airplanes and bagging their gear. There are many triumphs through this whole experience, Brooke told me, but there isn't a lot of rejoicing anymore. So sitting in the feed shed, Brooke decided to share that moment,
He called his girlfriend, who used to work for Operation Migration. He called Joe. Then he started calling craniacs, stopover hosts, many different kinds of people, all of whom had a hand in the project and who, Brooke realized, deserved to feel the same momentary sense of accomplishment, the illusion of closure, at least, that he was now forcing himself to feel. He must have called a dozen different people, he told me. And if the battery in my phone would have lasted, I could have stayed in there calling people for 4 or 5 days, when you think of all the people that have helped this project go forward. It was this collaborative aspect to the reintroduction that he was explaining now in the hangar, though the FAA inspectors seemed almost not to hear him as they knelt and prodded one of the trike's propeller guards. Soon, even I was only half listening, packing my backpack on the seat of my car, waiting for a free moment to say a last goodbye and head home. It was almost as if Brooke was standing in the hangar telling stories to himself, marveling about how, a few months out of every year, people welcome these strangers onto their land, open their homes, and keep them well fed, all for the sake of a wild animal they'll probably never see. And how unusual that is, if you take a moment and think about it. "These birds," I heard him say, "they've got a key that just unlocks the goodness of people." This is Fred Sanders. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America, by John Mualim. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by John McElroy. Wild Ones is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2013. All rights reserved. The book, Wild Ones, is available wherever Penguin Press books are sold.